Blog Talk Radio.
Shalom, shalom, everyone. This is Jaina Yisrael with an edition of Members of a Better World. I'm going to get the host of the show, Prince Asiel, on the line, and we're going to play a song. One moment, please. Prince Asiel, are you there? One moment. I'm going to play a song for you. Give our chance. I'll host the chance to call in. Just a second.
Me to also on the second half of my program today is to
bring that up. I've asked Prince Aleram to join me at that portion so that we can bring another perspective and broaden it so that our people will be fully aware. I want to say I've asked Professor Ezra Aharon to join me to talk about sovereignty. He has written several books on the issue of sovereignty, and I wanted him to be able to lay out, because he has studied the Hebraic culture as well in preparing to write his books, so he's looked at it politically, prophetically, as well as all of the angles in which to take a look at the world of sovereign nations and to see where we as Africans in America fit into that whole scheme of things. Professor, are you on the line yet? If so, hit the number one to join us for conversation.
I don't see him as of yet. I'm still waiting on Prince Aleram as well.
Okay. So what we'll do, though, Princess Yaina, is to begin to sort of talk about the sovereignty. And one of the reasons that I wanted to do that, this particular show, was that people got to understand when you say you were given the vision and the purpose to go and shift from religion to prophetic destiny as a people, and the Spirit of Yah gave you to begin to lay the prophetic foundation for the nation of Yehuda, the nation of Judah. And in the 49th chapter of the book of Bereshit, Genesis, the 8th verse, we are told that Judah is a lion's whelp. And he, like a young lion, is full of energy, full of spirit. And then he's an old lion. Who shall rouse him up? So you're talking about the Ancient of Days coming back again to resuscitate us as a people to get back on our destiny. And so God gave you the foundation to begin to put the call out to our people that it was, as in the 60s, they said it was nation time. But we didn't know what to do during nation time. We didn't know whether to build a nation in Mississippi or Alabama or Georgia, or just get up and go to Africa, as Garvey had suggested, Africa for Africans at home and abroad. We were determined that it was time to do for self. As the Honorable Elijah Muhammad had said, we needed some land of our own. But then you got the vision to tell the people that was a specific piece of land and a specific piece of land base between the Nile River from Uganda in the south to Iraq, Iran, all the way up to north, the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers were the boundaries of, and then the White Nile has a tributary that goes over to Central Africa. So you got the blue, the White Nile, and you got the Euphrates and the Tigris. These rivers are laid out, and also in the book of Genesis, in the second chapter, and it talks about those rivers flowing out of that special, special land. And if you've noticed, and if people are staying aware, they'll see that this is the most talked about, thought about, discussed piece of real estate on the planet today. We see all kind of movements taking place in the Holy Land, and we see all kind of people. And we did a position in 1983-84 that says, the gods vie for Africa, the Holy Land. So I wanted you and I to sort of talk a little bit about the Yehuda Nation and the vision that God gave you to begin to talk about it.
Oh, no problem. No problem. Absolutely. Our goal for the Nation of Yehuda is to gather our people together. When I received the mandate, I was actually in Christianity. And, you know, I've received the mandate from the Most High to build his nation. at that time, from a Christian perspective, I approached it from a Christian perspective, not really fully understanding what that entailed. It was only when he began to reveal, and you know, my uncle is deceased now, but he was the patriarch in our family that actually became conscious, and he gave me some advice. He said, you know, it's just like an onion. He said, the more when you peel back the first layer, you're gonna peel back the second layer, and you're gonna keep peeling back, and the more you peel back, the more it's gonna become apparent, and that's exactly what happened. That as I began to peel back the layer and understand who we were as a people, then I understood the magnitude of the call to be able to bring the people together. So the whole premise for the nation of Yehuda is to be there as a source so that we can be a foundation for the people when the Most High wakes them up. Because we are we are the most powerful nation on the planet, and people don't understand that, you know, from a spiritual perspective, even from a natural perspective, you know, this covenant was made by the Most High and given unto us, and no man can take it down. I mean, we are the most powerful people on the earth, and it would go to explain the magnitude that they've gone to keep us psychologically suppressed. So the whole purpose of it is to provide a vehicle for the people to understand who we are, what our prophetic journey is, and to be prepared when the time comes to make that great exodus.
Now, you should be looking for Professor Ezra. He's calling in now from a 732 area code.
Okay, let me see. I have him right here. I'll get him on right now.
Thank you.
Okay, his mic is open.
Professor Ezra Aharon, how are you? This is Prince Asiel.
Yes, I'm here. Great. I'm great. Good evening.
Professor, we have also on the line with us the head of the Yehuda Nation, Sister Yaina, and she has laid the foundation of why she was given the spirit to begin the prophetic gathering for sovereignty for the descendants of the biblical Israelites, whose prophetic destiny was to begin to rebuild in the latter days a sovereignty back into our purpose and destiny from the God of Israel. I want you to say hello to Professor Ezra, Sister Yaina.
Shalom, shalom, Professor Ezra. It's very nice to make your acquaintance.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm glad to be here. Thank you all for having me.
Now, Professor, one of the things I wanted to start off with is that you not only have written about sovereignty from a actual application point of view, you did the proper study by going to Africa, going into Israel, looking at those movements across America, coming out of Black America, whether it was the sovereignty issues being discussed by the Moors American community or the Honorable Elijah Muhammad Do Land for Self, and then politically you looked at it from an academic point of view to the point that your work was so valuable and recognized that you were asked to do a professorship at one of the universities that you can share with us, and you're teaching those classes now. What I'd like for you to do is to introduce yourself to the audience and give your background and what it is that you have determined that sovereignty is and should be for us as African people in America particularly and the African world in the diaspora.
Thank you. First of all, I want to say I've written two books on sovereignty. The first is titled Pawn Sovereignty, Dropping Black Perspectives on Americanization, Africa, War, and Reparations. And the second book is titled Sovereign Evolution, Manifest Destiny from Civil Rights to Sovereign Rights. And I have a third book now in the process of being published that will be released by the end of this year that's titled The Sovereign Psyche. And what my work does is it looks at the concept and the consciousness of sovereignty from perspective of Africans in America, from a historical development sense as well as future potential. In a historical developmental sense, my work begins with the foundation that African people in America who were enslaved were sovereign and were part of sovereign kingdoms, sovereign constructs, sovereign empires long before they ever arrived here on the shores of this hemisphere. And so what the world looked at and what the world now presently defines as sovereignty was something that Africans had long implemented before coming here. And the definition that I use for sovereignty, I use a definition from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which states that sovereignty is a modern notion of political authority that's expressed on two levels, one being practical institutions, the other being political thought. Practical institutions, political thought. It is those two pillars that my work rests upon in terms of identifying, understanding the process in how one or how groups of people develop that political thought and then are able to translate those political thoughts into practical, functional institutions whereby their nationhood, whereby their statehood is strengthened in a way that they are able to be distinct within the international pecking order or the international community of nations, that as well sovereignty is ranked on a scale, whether one is exercising absolute sovereignty, whether one is exercising limited forms of sovereignty, whether one simply has sovereign aspirations, the desire to be sovereign. And so when you look at the history of African people in America, we were not introduced to government and civil society, organized societies and governments, constitutional law. We weren't introduced to those things here. Neither were Africans introduced to those things in Paris or Rome or Greece. Africa had standing sovereign constructs that comprised governments, organized societies. They had constitutions. They had written laws. They had oral laws, practices, and so forth. And so prior to the 1500s, you'll find that Africa had sovereignties that were on par or greater than any of the comparative sovereignties that existed anywhere throughout the world. And so why is that important to know? It's important to know because, as my first book, the title, expresses, we, in essence, pawned our sovereignty. We took something that had a greater value, and in exchange we received something of a lesser value. But what's important about that is to understand that there's a process and there are means by which a people who have lost their sovereignty can, in essence, regain it. And so basically, in an encapsulated way, that's what my work entails.
Well, one of the great things that I wanted you to share with this audience is that there is a movement of Fresh Again by some men and women who have organized themselves in what they now call the United Nations of Israel. And they're pushing for a sovereign position between the Nile and the Euphrates as part of the historical biblical lands that was given, they believe, by the Creator to his people. And when we look back historically and we see the nations that had prominence in what is called biblical history were strong empires between the Nile and the Euphrates, and even today we see with modern-day Iraq and Iran. And let's take, for instance, the movement that is taking place now. There are people in what is called Kurdistan that says that they are sovereign people, and there are many people now in those lands that are pushing for sovereignty. So I wanted you to speak to those movements and what is the basis. And then we've seen since World War II that nations have disappeared, as when the Soviets swallowed up those lands, and then they reappeared, and then part of those lands that from the Soviet Union is called those from the Caucasus Mountains, and there's a book written about the 13th tribe that says that their descendants, when their king or ruler converted to Judaism, that's how the Jews in that part of the world believe that they came into existence. So I just want you to begin to share with us your research into those movements.
Mm-hmm. Well, first, it's interesting because when you look at the world prior to World War One, you find that most of Central Europe and Eastern Europe as well were not comprised of the nation states that we know of today. During that time, Europe, that portion of Europe was basically divided into the three empires, the Romanov Empire, the Ottoman Empire, and the Habsburg Empire. And out of the unscrambling of those empires, we find the nations that basically exist today. And then when we saw the breakup of Yugoslavia just recently, what we were really seeing was like a continuation of acts in a play of this unscrambling of these empires where Europeans, although they may profess ideals of equality, and you may think that they are about integration, they themselves prove that sovereign identities are unique in particular for them to contain, to maintain, which is why you no longer see them as they are. So basically Europe now, each nation is comprised of their own particular types of groups that have common ancestry, common history, common bloodline. What we see with the Kurds is interesting because they are an unsovereign people, and one of the principles that I always speak about is that unsovereign people pay unsovereign consequences. Maybe something small and seemingly insignificant in the short term, like, say, with Africans in America, you send your children to school and they learn brands of history that exclude them or marginalize or make footnotes of them, and it's seemingly insignificant, but ultimately the long term it has devastating consequence because they know not who they are in history or have any sense of continuity of bloodline, which is one of the things that's important to the European construct of sovereignty. When you're unsovereign, it may be something that is extraordinarily detrimental in capacity in an immediate sense. You can look at blacks in South Africa, Sharpeville, Soweto, massacres, and these are all unsovereign consequences that people pay. So the Kurds, they, to this day, are paying unsovereign consequences, being a people who, between Iraq, Iran, Syria, Turkey, they are people who are seeking and searching for political and ideological self-identity with statehood. And so the point that I'm making is that this human quest for sovereign powers is something that is ancient, it's something that is modern, and it's something that will continue into the future. The unique thing about the struggle of Africans in America is that it's been based largely upon these immeasurable concepts of equality and integration. You know, what is equality? How do you measure it? You know, I always say that political equality is much different than mathematical equality, where in math you have the sum of two variables, they prove to be identical in value. And political equality is somewhat of a different construct because, you know, if you don't have money and you have a court case, you get poor man's justice. If you don't have the resources and you're going to attend a school in an area that perhaps is dilapidated with teachers who are unaccredited, maybe in asbestos-laden buildings and so forth. So these are misnomers and concepts that you can't really measure. So my point was that Africans in America have struggled for this concept of equality and integration in large part absent of what the concept and consciousness of sovereignty is all about. So my work attempts to connect the dots of the unsovereign aspects of Africans in America to the world of sovereignty as we know it and how the unfoldment of the pecking order of power that we know of in the world today has unfolded. And as I just gave the example from 1914, World War I up until today.
Now, one of the things that I wanted you to touch on, too, so that the listening audience will understand, would you give us a little bit about how you come to reach these conclusions and write in terms of your research?
I didn't hear you. Broke up a little bit. Say that again, please.
I said, could you give the listening audience a little background on yourself, how you reach these conclusions from your research and your travels? Give us a little biography on...
You're breaking up. I heard, give the audience a background.
Can you hear me better now?
Okay. Go ahead, please.
Okay. What I'm saying, I wanted you to give the audience how you reach these conclusions and what gives you the authority to speak so emphatically on these issues. So I wanted them to know that you're not just the person that watched a movie and came to these conclusions, but give us a history of when you went into Africa and what you've done to reach these conclusions and the research that you have done also, so they will know that they're listening to an authentic voice of about sovereignty and the importance of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, my background, I've spent a large portion of my adult life living and working in West Africa and working on consulting projects with various entities in West Africa. I've worked for many years with the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. I've worked with the African Economic Commission. I've worked with the United Nations on different projects, and I've traveled extensively throughout Africa. And my works, my books, not only being referenced and used in universities here in America, but also throughout Africa. And from what I understand, in some eight parts of Asia as well. So my work, if you were to just take out the elements as they relate to Africans in America and look at it simply from a standpoint of sovereignty, I provide in modern times what some have said to be an overall critique of sovereignty in ways that you don't get in any particular one or two particular references or textbooks. So a lot of what I talk about in terms of sovereignty, these things are based on principle. A lot of the other things I talk about related to sovereignty are based on history. And then I simply take a combination of those things and apply it to the African-American experience. And so the validation of my work has come from the fact that universities have recognize my work. You'll find my books in university libraries. You'll find my books being quoted in courses. You'll find a lot of the articles that I've written being used in courseware in various universities. When I first came to Delaware State, I found that some professors were using my work more than I was using my work. So it's been a validation of it through the acceptance of my work in various university settings.
Now, so that the audience will know, you spoke about those three major empires that was controlling all of most of the planet known at that time. Was Habsburg, was the Ottoman Empire, and
Romanov
Empire out of Rome, because Rome, Ottoman Empire stood for 1,400 years. Rome stood close to 800 years, and the Habsburg was, I don't remember the exact length of time, but it was all the way up until the First World War that they were a major player on the earth. Now we see out of those things, those modern European and Eastern European nations have, come back into existence, just like we saw in our time. The Soviet Union came into existence as an empire. Russia moved to the communist world, and I think it was like 21 or 22 nations that they swallowed up under their communist empire. And then the British boasted that the sun never set on the great British Empire, and they now have a commonwealth, which is about 100-plus nations to this day. And then this European world has remnants of the Greek world that talks about philosophy and its thinking with Aristotle and Euripides and all of those. And then it talks about the aspect of Roman law imposed upon the modern European world and the world today. So how did these individual nations come into existence that did not exist prior to World War I and after World War II? How did they then come back into existence?
Well, the tribal construct of Europe, if you want to use that term, you know, those people inhabited those countries, inhabited those lands for centuries. Sovereignty, of course, being much different then than it is now, nevertheless, those people occupied those territories. And so what we saw was a refashioning of those nations, a reconstitution of those nations by using the modern laws, the modern protocols to develop statehood. You know, we saw Yugoslavia transform into Bosnia, Albania, and Croatia, Kosovo, all these countries that, you know, people can't even explain what happened. But there's a process by which a people can undertake nationhood, which is not something made up or, you know, something mystical. You know, there are steps in a process to be taken that leads to statehood, which is why I always say that, you know, my work talks about sovereignty conceptually in terms of bringing about the consciousness. But, you know, there are legal dynamics and aspects of sovereignty, which you get into when you talk about, well, how do you form a nation? You know, how did modern Slovenia come into existence out of Yugoslavia? How did modern Bosnia and so forth come into existence out of Yugoslavia? So when you're talking about sovereignty, you also are talking about a complex process that people undergo to put the different pieces into place to actually bring birth to statehood. So even from an African standpoint in America, how does it happen? I always tell audiences, you know, I don't bring the model of, well, it's going to look like this, it's going to be this way, it's going to be here, this is what's going to happen, because, you know, sovereignties are always different. They transform over periods of time. You know, it could be sovereignty for Africans in America, if there ever were to be such a thing, in dual places or beginning with dual citizenships. So this is why the subject is important, because it merits discussions on very deep levels, and it requires a sovereign nucleus, serious-minded people to take the steps to make it possible. So I always give the example of America. 56 men signed their names on a piece of paper, called it a Declaration of Independence, and shipped it over to King George, and then they said, they're a nation. And out of that 56 men who signed that paper, you'll find that the whatever it was, 3 million, almost 4 million people who were here in America at that time, you had segments of them who totally disagreed with them, who didn't want any part of rebelling against the king. But my point is, ultimately, from those 56 men, you have what has developed an ideal of Americanization, whereby you had maybe up to 1 million people who were enslaved at that time. Now you have 20 million Africans here in America who get up in the morning and yawn and feel and embrace Americanization based on what initially started as signatures by 56 men on a piece of paper. So I'm saying all that to say, you know, there's a process, and, you know, it's different in many cases, but, you know, there are basic protocols to follow in modern times to make it really happen.
And one of the reasons I brought that up is that I go back to the U.S. and in constitutional law, there was a case about the Amistad, and this was a group of African slaves who rebelled on the high seas and international waters, and they drifted to the shores of America. And that case was argued as to whether they were free men from sovereign lands in Africa, or whether they were to be thrown in as slaves. And ultimately, that case was decided that the Amistad were men who were freed and had their right to return back to their lands. And I think they talked about Sierra Leone being part of that land. The reason I bring that up is that was in about 1841 or something, but by 1857, there was a runaway slave, an individual, that was captured, and then this case went to court to talk about the rights of this freed man. He had left Missouri and went west to some land there, and the case was argued before Roger B. Taney, the judge at that time of the Supreme Court, who wrote the major opinion that there were no rights that a black man had that a white man was bound to respect, because in framing the Constitution, they were considered three-fifths of a human being for the purpose of voting. So they had no legal standing in at that time the courts of America to make that determination to free him, and so he had to be returned back as a slave. In your research and study, what rights do Africans in America to go back prior to their becoming enslaved in America to be those free men and women that they were before they were captured and brought to the Americas to work for those who captured them and lost all human rights as human beings? What is it in the human rights area that gives the African in America the right to return back to his own sovereignty? Because I hear all the time those who say they are descendants now of the biblical Israelites are standing on the prophetic word that they believe that their God gave them not to ever submit to an enslavement, and that their God was their redeemer as well as their king and lawgiver. Have your research caused you to have any thoughts or ideas on how that movement, using the principles of sovereignty, can begin to alert the world to a real serious movement among the descendants of that great empire that existed under King Solomon, King David, and those great men that were the seers of vision for an African people? Because they, prophets speak of, Abraham speaks of, know of a surety that thy seed will be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and they shall serve them, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. And then he says, but afterwards they will be returned back to their land. How do they build a solid legal international world case on the basis of what they believe is an accurate description of them and their history?
Mm-hmm. Let me say back to Senbe Pie or Joseph Senku, who was ultimately freed. It shows in that example that there was at times recognition of Africans being free, being sovereign in Africa. And laws at that time were being fashioned so that the importation of slaves in America was illegal. And so, you know, you had over time, as laws were being constructed, that Africans were either, it was being done either to their benefit or detriment, if you could look at it in that sense. So with the Amistad, it showed that, you know, there are glimpses, there is a recognition of the sovereignty of Africa as well. You could go all the way back to the 1520s when the Portuguese were first ransacking coastal kingdoms in West Africa. And you'll find one king in what was the Congolese Empire at the time. His name was Mbemba. And he wrote to the king of Portugal. In essence, he was saying, your men are coming here. They're destroying the kingdom. They're taking a lot of the royal people. They're taking people of my family. And he was asking him to intercede so that there could be peace between the kingdoms. And ultimately, the Portuguese calmed down their raiding in that particular Congolese kingdom. So you'll find many examples when you research it here and there where the sovereignty of Africa was being recognized. You have an example of Prince Abdul Rahman, who was enslaved in Mississippi, came to America in 1788 and spent 40 years enslaved here. And by 1828, he ultimately went back to Africa. The same John Quincy Adams who argued the case with the Amistad, he was president at the time. And when he found out that Prince Abdul Rahman was actually a prince from Africa, he interceded to ensure that Prince was free. And Prince Abdul Rahman, magnificent story of his struggle, went to the White House. If I'm sure, you know, one of the earliest people to ever enter the White House, and certainly one of the earliest Africans to have an audience with a president, and he did it on two occasions. He met with Quincy Adams twice. Ultimately, he went back to Africa, and he was released under the full knowledge that he had come from a sovereign kingdom. So, you know, those stories exist. The thing is that it's important to be able to have sovereignty as a lens by which to look through in order to identify these examples where sovereignties do exist and where sovereignties are acknowledged.
Well, one of the things that, as a young man growing up in America, that I was doing research on was what happened to us and how did we end up in this predicament. And I happened to run across a historian and biblical scholar by the name of S.B. Yehuda, which later became Prince Shelig Ben Yehuda, but prior to that, as a minister within the Church of God in Christ, he ultimately left the church and began to do the sovereign research of his identity and the people that he was connected to. And he told me that in the beginning of the Church of God in Christ, Bishop Mason, who formed that church, initially was talking about the sovereignty of most of the former slaves in America were descendants of the biblical Israelites, and they were enslaved based on a prophetic word that he said God had revealed to him that we would begin to prepare to return. Now, the founder of the Yehuda Nation, Sister Yaina, traces her bloodline, you were talking about bloodline, back to that of the sovereign kingdom of King David, of the Hebrew nation that was ordained and maintained by what they believed was their God-given rights. I became an integral part of that movement because I was resurrected mentally and became a prince within that structure, just like you were talking about John Quincy Adams. And I began to move around America. We first started at the United Nations talking about it, and then ultimately that was a community of Hebrew Israelites that went into Liberia, and then subsequently in 1969.
You're breaking up somewhere.
There was a movement of Israelites in America in 1967 that left and went into West Africa to begin to cleanse and spiritually detox themselves in preparation for returning back to their sovereign homeland of Israel. So in 1948, the United Nations made a decision through the pressure of the Zionist movement that started in 1895 by Theodore Herzl to begin to find a homeland for those who were descendants of the biblical Israelites. And so his argument was that they failed.
I can hardly hear.
Can you hear me now?
Hello?
You can't hear me now.
Yeah, it's breaking up, though. But
I'm going to try to call from another phone, because if this one is messing up, I don't know what to do. So I'll try to call back in from another line.
Okay, that's better.
Okay. Then what I was saying is that following that line of logic, that President John Quincy Adams gave freedom to Prince Rahman and repatriated him back to his country, then the record in America is that when one can prove their independent sovereignty, they ought to be given the right to reconnect with their past, because just like the leader that was being raided by the Portuguese recognized the importance of the process, and you were talking about these principles, and I'm saying in 1948 the world was forced to revisit the whole question of the Jewish empire. And the reason that it was called Jewish at that time was because it was basically the kingdom of Judah that the Romans overtook, because the northern kingdom had fallen. So now the Judean kingdom that later became the Jewish people, short for Judah, the Jew became European, just like the southern Africa, after they dominated what is now modern South Africa, the European began to call himself the Afrikaner. So, and he called the original people Bantu. So he knew that he needed to identify with Africa, so he called himself the Afrikaner. And that began a 60, 70-year history with finding out that the people in South Africa lost their sovereignty through European domination out of the Dutch and out of the British. And then the people further lost their rights in all of those independent kingdoms. And then after either armed struggle for asserting their sovereign rights or political negotiations, all of those countries now you see have come back into their own. And I'm saying the African in America, I'm asking this question, who has determined that his sovereign rights is connected to ancient Israel, what would you recommend is the proper legal process from your study of sovereignty should they go through?
Well, I'm not certain that seems to be a body of work that if someone explored that, they could possibly develop the argument for that. In my work, I relate it back to the kingdoms of West Africa, beginning with the Ghana Empire, Songhai Empire, Mali Empire, and deal with the kingdoms that existed during that particular time, and enslavement and bringing Africans from those kingdoms to the U.S., that particular argument and experience of sovereignty. But that whole element is something that you outlined is something that certainly is deserving of some form of scholarship. I'm just not versed enough to give any insights that I'm sure anyone would find very informative.
That's perfect. Then what I'd like to suggest that is that you as a sovereignness, that's what I'm coining you now, with the validation of West African empires, Mali, Songhai, Timbuktu, and then the modern Europeans have been recognized to have dominated that land. One of the things that I discovered in my travels to West Africa is I visited the late Sheikh Anta Diop, Sinhalese historian and anthropologist, and I went and searched out him to find out whether or not in his travels to Northeast Africa, where the original people of those lands had he determined through science, research, and history, if they were African people. And he said yes. And then I asked him a follow-up question. Then, do you accept the reality that the people that lived in Egypt for 400 years that were identified as Jews or Hebrews, would they also have been African people? And he said, because the African gene is dominant and the white gene is recessive, it is no way that 70 whites could have went into Africa and turned them white. But if they were African people, they would still be African people today. And we are recognizing the reality of that by going back not by power, not by might, but by the legal process that I was hooked up with in facing the United Nations. So I'm just raising that because this show sometimes deals with those kind of issues, and Sister Yaina herself is dealing with the nation of Judah being resuscitated, and I've committed myself to working with her and others to begin to repair and seriously do that work. So I just wanted to put that in. Now, I'd like to stop right now to see if there are some questions that the listeners have, so that, and then I wanted you to announce where they could get your books and if they got organizations that pay a speaker's fee to invite you to come and lecture to their group or organization, if that's okay with you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Well, what I'd like to do then is have you give out your information so that those listening can know how to get in touch with you through your email and how to get your books. So let's start with that.
Right. Listeners can visit my website, www.EzraSpeaks. That's Ezra with an H, E-Z-R-A-H. Ezra Speaks, S-P-E-A-K-S. And my email and all the information regarding my books are there. You can purchase my books from my publisher, Author House. There's a link on my site to go directly to my publisher's website. And all of my contact information is there, phone number and email. Right at www.EzraSpeaks.com.
Now, where are you teaching at the university, Professor?
I'm currently at Delaware State University in Dover, Delaware.
And those classes are connected with the history department or psychology department? What branch of education are you teaching from?
History and political science. I teach both history and political science courses.
Perfect. I'd like to go to Sister Yaina and see if she has questions or if there's anybody who has called in and want to ask a question.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it was excellent. We do have a caller that's been on hold for a moment. Area code 504, your mic is open, you're on the air.
Well, good afternoon. I appreciate the radio show. It's been my first time listening to it. So I would like to thank the speaker for coming on, as well as the host for having this show. I do have one question, or a question that's a little bit directly to the speaker, and that is this. One, you've given out a part of my question, that which is, could you name your books, if you would? I missed that portion of it, and give your address again. But also, should African Americans be seeking national minority status as outlined in the as outlined in international law as a first step towards sovereignty?
Could you say that again? You broke up a little bit. I didn't quite get everything.
My question is, should African Americans be seeking national minority status as outlined in international law as a first step towards sovereignty?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've read about that, and I always say I'm open to any step that would open dialogue and discourse towards what ultimately would be any form of sovereign recognition. I think it would be healthy, not just for Africans in America, but for America and the world. I think that we have a story to tell. We have a perspective that needs to have a sovereign outlet. And I think that the world would be a better place if we had that type of recognition. So, yes, I do agree with that in terms of minority status. At the same time, alongside of that, there are other instruments that should be looked at and assessed to see where those instruments are also applicable. So the important thing is that the discourse evolves. And from that discourse, that begins to create the very basis of that political thought that's necessary, as I began the conversation, the political thought that's necessary to build the functional, practical institution.
I want to jump in. Of course, there have been movements from the beginning, whether it be Denmark Vesey, whether it be Nat Turner, whether it be the Honorable Marcus Garvey, who've all tried to launch these programs, including the latest issue in 67 when a group of African Americans decided to go back to Israel. And as you know, when Kwame Nkrumah opened up Ghana, he opened it up for the African Americans who felt the need to repatriate back to Africa. And the late W.B.E. Du Bois went there and spent his last years there. So with Professor Ezra opening up the modern discussion now of sovereignty, I think it's incumbent upon those who want to continue to do the research and, as he said, begin to organize those efforts that will bring the many sovereign movements, whether it be in Central, South, East, or North Africa, to begin to have those discussions. Because we see right now the importance of owning a piece of real estate where you can guide and resurrect your land, your language, and your culture. So I encourage all of the listeners to begin to take serious. And that's why I've aligned myself with the Yehuda movement, because they are serious, making efforts to expose the world of those who believe they are descendants of the biblical Israelites. And I've also been engaged in dialogue with Brother Avraham, who has began to organize Israelite movements into a sovereign movement of collective thinking about how to do that, as well as work with Better World in Israel, who have landed on the land, and we've begun to develop a way in which we can effectively put out the best way to begin to repatriate. So there are a number of proactive things. I've traveled from West to East Africa. I've traveled to the Caribbean and to South America. I've got brothers and sisters all over the planet that's talking about we deserve to dictate our own. And I just added the caveat, as long as we know that we've got power and truth to strengthen and to support the positions that we take. Ezra, you want to repeat the names of your books?
Yes. Pawn Sovereignty, Dropping Black Perspectives on American Nation, Africa, War, and Reparation. And then Sovereign Evolution, Manifest Destiny from Civil Rights to Sovereign Rights. And you can look out for my third book later in the year, The Sovereign Psyche. And all of those are listed on my website, www.ezraspeaks.com. That's ezraspeaks.com.
And I would encourage all the listeners to purchase those books, put it in your library, and begin to study clearly how we can effectively begin to repatriate ourselves first with understanding, knowledge, and truth, and then how to intellectually get into discussions where you are standing on solid political, legal, and spiritual grounds as you argue, I am who I am. And so I took it serious, got on a plane, and went to Africa and began to do this research and this discussion to the point that I know people know about the Hebrew Israelite movement that I was spearheading and informing intellectuals, politicians, world-class leaders and world leaders both inside and outside of America. And I encourage all of those under the hearing of this program to begin to do the same and to write to us so that we will know who you are and make contact. And I'll give you my details so that you can write as well to me and to the Yehuda Nation, so that we can pass on that information to the relevant people that we are in contact with. Ezra, as your portion of this program is coming to an end.
Thank you, sir.
Are there anything that you want the audience to remember about what you've said and shared with us and what they should do as the next step for becoming a sovereign people?
Mm-hmm. Well, in closing, just let me say that the world is light years away from the 1960s when riding in front of a bus was a symbol of freedom. Where you physically sit on the bus today is something that's relatively cosmetic. You know, when you consider the geopolitics that go into the making of the bus, whether it's the gas that keeps it going, whether it's the chromium that's a part of the bus's body, whether it's the rubber that makes the tires. Chances are these resources are connected to Africa in some kind of way. So I'm saying that to say that our conceptions as well as our moral obligations to what we know of as freedom, that it has to continually evolve. And it has to evolve in pace with the demands and the circumstances of today's political time. And so in these times, the world revolves around on individual nations' axis of sovereign powers. And when you're outside of those powers, as I said, unsovereign people pay unsovereign consequences. And so it's important to understand how this pecking order of world powers, how it's been established, and what's necessary in terms of developing the political thought, the practical institution, to be a part of it.
Thank you so much, Professor, and I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to us doing an interview in the future again so we can continue to bring this kind of in-depth information to my listening audience, to our people, and to people in general across the world, so that they will know that the African in America has not completely dropped off the scene, and he's still fighting for his sovereign rights as human beings on this planet to go back and pick up his prophetic historical destiny that he has. And I thank you so very much, Professor.
Thank you.
All right. Sister Yaina?
Yes, sir.
I wanted to switch over to discuss with L. Rahm about health and Ebola. I meant to talk to Professor because of his experience in Africa to see what comments he may have, and if he's still listening, he may want to let us know again that he's got some comments about Ebola. But in listening to your program yesterday, I talked with Prince L. Rahm, and he shared with me some of his information and research that he had did from a historical point of view about what has happened to African Americans and to Africans about these various plagues and diseases. Prince L. Rahm, are you on the line?
Yes, he's here. He just has to push one. Also, from the chat room, the guys or the people in the chat room says that it keeps breaking up, so I don't know what's going on in terms of their conception of whether they can actually hear, and the professor has hung up, but I will get Prince L. Rahm on the line because I can hear you pretty clear, but they're saying that it keeps breaking up, so it may be the location where you're standing or something in your room. I'm not sure, but I'm going to open up his mic right now. Prince L. Rahm, your mic is open.
Thank you. Peace and blessings, and shalom to you, Prince Asiya.
Thank you, Nazi. I'm sorry that this wire is breaking up. It happens from time to time. We're used to forces jamming these airways. But what I wanted to talk with you about, I was able to hear about the Yehuda's Nation interest in what is taking place in Africa. And if you don't mind, if I can sort of frame a little bit, that in the first time in history, African presidents were gathered in Washington, D.C., under an African-American president who called for the leadership of Africa to come and sit and share with the American public not only their physical presence, but their vision. And at that same time they were visiting, the front page stories every day were carrying about this deadly disease called Ebola when African presidents were in. So I'm saying that that was purposeful and intentional. But also I know that viruses are serious illness and that we need to be aware of. What do you say, and what have your research shown you about Africa and viruses and plagues and diseases? So give us a little overview of what you have found out and what we ought to be cognizant and conscious of.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that along with a lot of other people, and just in terms of being interested in world affairs or the world politics, so to speak, that the information that we get from Africa, beyond a shadow of a doubt, is biased and slanted toward the negative. And also that I lived in West Africa for 12 years, so I'm not just speaking from a perspective of an armchair lecturer, okay? So my experience there, and then to myself being subjected to the malaria virus and other things that occur in West Africa. So my point is that with African sensationalism reporting slanted to the negative, the assumption is that because Africa, in terms of imagery, underdeveloped, lacking modern facilities, lacking effective leadership or corrupted leadership, or just being slow and backwards, period, that any information that comes from there reinforces that stereotype. Okay, so everywhere in this world you have ailments. Africa is not immune to ailments, and that's another misnomer that I would like to address now in terms of we on this side and anywhere else in the world that we are, in terms of we look at Africa and the pastime paradise that it was as if it was absolutely perfect, spot-free, disease-free, et cetera, et cetera. So we have this illusion of Africa as it was and as it exists today. Africa, people get sick and they need doctors and they need medical care and they need to be aware of their diet and they need clean drinking water, et cetera, just like everybody else does in this world. But even with those circumstances, people are still subject to epidemics, to infections, viruses, et cetera. Okay? So that's the first thing, that Africa is not immune to any of these things, and we are human beings like everybody else. And so we have a physical presence that we have to maintain or upkeep in order to keep our immune system strong enough to resist, reject, and destroy most pathogens. Okay, so in reporting Ebola, I believe it's the last count, maybe let's say to round it up, I'd say between 1,000, maybe 1,500 people at this point, they say have been affected by or have succumbed to Ebola. Well, in America, one in 25 people who go to the hospital get an infection. One in every 25 people in modern, high-tech, best facilities, supposedly America, one in 25 get infected at the hospital. Now, you know how many millions of people go to the hospital every year, so we can do the math from there. It's way more than 1,500 or 1,000 or 1,500 people who have succumbed to Ebola. So let's get that straight about they're so backwards and they can't deal with it. And America, who can? In fact, they brought people from West Africa with Ebola here saying that, oh, with the facilities that we have, with what we got, we can, you know, we can deal with it. We can bring them here without a problem, et cetera, et cetera. All right? One in 25 people who go to the hospital in America right now contract infections in the hospital. The other thing is that there are other things in Africa that are far more egregious than the Ebola virus. And I will say, let's just take one. Let's take malaria. Now, malaria is down 50% from the year 2000. That's only 14 years ago. It's down 50% from then. But right now, as we speak, a child, an African child, dies every minute from malaria. Okay, so if we want to talk about something, if we want to sensationalize something, okay, if we want to draw attention to something, how much more so to malaria than this small fraction, relatively speaking, number of people who have succumbed to a virus and they say it's so virulent there's no cure and it does all these terrible things and you can't touch the body for 21 days, et cetera, sensationalizing the backwardsness of Africa when in fact, if you're concerned about Africa, there's something very real that can be dealt with or where your concern can be placed in terms of dealing with malaria as it affects the African person.
Are you saying then that we should not be concerned about Ebola to the degree that it could destroy all of black people and African people, or that we should be afraid to touch Africans or anybody that come from Africa? What are you saying?
I'm saying that, first of all, that we should always be aware and take care to take care of our health and the health of our loved ones and the health of the people around us. Okay? So, we're aware. And yes, we deal with those things as they occur. But the impression that's being given about Ebola is erroneous. Okay? That the in nature or as we understand life is based on the principle of duality or opposites or balance. Okay? For every action, there's a reaction. We understand it like that. Some of us understand it like that. Okay? You cannot tell me that there's something in existence, okay, that doesn't have a balance or an opposite, that there's something in existence that can't be neutralized by balance, or that there's something that can't be found in that same environment to neutralize it and bring things into balance. Okay? Other than that, how is it that Americans can bring Ebola victims over here, but Ebola victims can't be dealt with in Africa? This is the sensationalism about Africa and negativity about Africa that I'm speaking to, and we should be well aware that there's always this effort to cast Africa in a negative light. That's what I'm saying. Of course, we are concerned and aware and should be. And take care of ourselves, okay, in any situation or anywhere that we find ourselves, including America.
I followed up on that hospital statistics. 75 1,000 people die every year in American hospitals from infections that they got from going to the hospital for something else.
Okay, but when it's reported, too, when it's reported, it's not reported in a negative light. It's not reported like it's an epidemic. It's not reported like it's something out of control. It's not reported like it doesn't have a cure and we can't do anything about it. It's not reported like that. But the Ebola virus is, and we're talking about an outbreak, sporadic outbreak. There's been a reported Ebola outbreak maybe 15 years ago, 10, 15, let's say between 10 and 20 years ago. And some people succumbed to it, okay? And then there wasn't. And now there's a resurgence, and so 1,000 to 1,500 people, okay? So we're saying that
1,000 people haven't died, though.
Okay, that's right. I mean, 1,000 people have contracted it, 1,500 people have contracted it, and they give a figure, what, maybe a percentage from either 40 to 70% maybe fatal. They don't report on those who survive. Now, you don't hear that part, and I appreciate you bringing that to the forefront. You don't hear that part that everybody doesn't die from it, which means there's a way to recover.
You were mentioning malaria, and I said that 7 million people a year contracted. White people went into southern Africa and took over and lived there. And I've never heard there was a white scare about malaria in South Africa and in Zimbabwe and in Angola and all of these places where black people are dying, supposedly. It's not affecting other people like that. The largest group of people going into Africa now are the Chinese, and we never hear of any detrimental plague to the people that have gone there or the Europeans who have dominated Africa for the last 500 years. So I'm just making sure that our people don't take the Kool-Aid and believe that Africa, the land of all of the wealth of God, is now a place where black people cannot live. And they've been living there since the beginning of time.
Right.
It's a lifestyle that I said that is brought about. According to the way I study, it says the wages of sin is death. So there are some things that need to be corrected that balances. And as the children of Israel know, there's a way that seems right, but it's wrong. So I'm saying we now must get truth in order to live on this planet to avert the plagues. There's no sense talking about the last days, and there won't be any people left except those who do those things to preserve the quality of life that we all say that our God is going to give us.
You're absolutely right, Prince, and I agree with you 100%. And in my firsthand experience in living there and observing circumstances and myself being affected or contracting malaria on several occasions, I can speak to the fact that anywhere that you are, I don't care what people you are, there are sanitation standards that you have to maintain. You have to have clean drinking water. Your diet has to be, you have to be circumspect about your diet. You cannot have the mentality of eating anything that moves, okay? You cannot have the mentality of being lax about waste materials and the disposal of them. You cannot be the infrastructure or the officials or those who are leading the people cannot be unaware that you have to make efforts, all right, to push back against things that will overtake you. You mentioned the Chinese. You mentioned the Europeans. They're not afraid to come to Africa. They know that these things are there, but these things exist wherever they are, okay, in China too, okay, in Europe too. The bubonic plague reduced the population of Europe by 25 million people. 25 million people. Now, when they talk about, the bubonic plague versus Ebola now. We're saying 25 million people perished, okay? And then we're saying with Ebola, 1,000 to 1,500 people have contracted it, and all of a sudden you get all of this African negative sensationalism news as these heads of state are in Washington, D.C., trying to present themselves in a dignified manner and negotiate for fair trade treaties, et cetera, et cetera. And it's an embarrassment.
Well, let me just raise a question with you that I seem to keep hearing being said. It seems strange that Nigeria has oil, and it has the best oil that you can buy, sulfur-free. Now they found Ebola there. Liberia has iron, large quantities of iron, diamonds, and gold. Guinea have the finest diamonds in the world, and so does Sierra Leone. All of these places that have these very important resources for the Western world are now frightening black people and telling them they better not go there. Other than that, they're going to get instant death. And so the Europe continue to go, control the resources, and therefore maintain their wealth and riches over African lands and African resources. What do you say about that?
Well, I'd also like to add that in West Africa, you have millions of acres under cultivation for rubber trees to provide rubber for these vehicles that are being manufactured around the world, too. And so what I say to that is that also these circumstances keep people who would otherwise be concerned or who would otherwise may want to go to develop Africa in a positive way, they're discouraged against doing that. And by discouraging them against doing that, it opens it wide open because the people become desperate for interaction or trade or foreign exchange or the ability to trade on the foreign markets. So they're reduced to a very low level, and they literally find themselves in indentured servitude, all right, just to provide a minimal economy so that they can survive, all right. Now, under those conditions, right, then things go lacking, like sanitation, okay, like education, things that would put people in a position where they could put themselves in a better position as it relates to the dangers that it can exist in the environment if a certain standard is not maintained. But again, I say that.
Let me just jump in. For instance, I read that there are over 100 million rats living underground in New York.
Okay. And it was rats that bore the fleas that was the source of the bubonic plague. So if we're going to talk about areas or we're going to sensationalize something, how much more so these conditions and under every major city, even lesser than major cities, because of the way that waste is dealt with here in this country, okay, that the rats are able to thrive, and not only thrive, they're literally, if you go out into the streets of any of these large cities at night, in certain sections of these cities, if not all over, the rats are in total control.
The reason that I wanted to bring this side of the health issue out is that in spite of all of that, the Tuskegee experiment when infecting black men with syphilis and let that go unabated for 40 years. Can you imagine promoting black promiscuity and on and on and on? We now see that the only thing that have protected us is our spirit of God to do what is right and to desire that. So I'm saying to the Yehuda Nation, to the better world, that we are the vanguard for lifting up truth so that you can fight these lies. And we're saying, be very conscious of your health and take serious every warning that's put out there. But know that behind it, there's a plan, just like we've read in the biblical days. And remember, the plagues that were on Egypt were caused by the attack on the children of Israel to prevent them from being free. And God brought those plagues and curses upon the Egyptian empire to so that the people could go free. So be careful. What may look one way is prophetic justice for God's people. Now,
Brother, I'd like to add that we understand that the people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, but also because they rejected knowledge. And I'm saying that to make this point about us as a people, even more specific, us as Israelites, that you need to consider what you're not going to do. As the example that I want to raise is about diet. When you start talking about diet, inevitably what the people start telling you is what they ain't going to stop doing. All right? So that's the point that I'm making. I ain't going to stop doing this. I ain't going to stop doing that. I ain't going to stop doing this. Okay? Well, then don't talk about a health issue. All right? Because your concern is not at the level to justify your complaint. Okay? When the concern reaches the level, all right, that it needs to be at, then a lot of these things that we're talking about will be eliminated automatically. But we have a frame of mind about what we're not going to do, what we used to. I don't see no problem with it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Rejecting the knowledge necessary to be where it is that we say that we want to be. Okay, the two can't coexist peacefully. It's either one or the other. Either you're concerned to the point where everything comes under examination relative to whether it's helping you or hurting you or not. And if it's not, then let's have another discussion because you're really not serious about the one we have.
For instance, 500,000 people die every year from cigarette smoking. Every year. And the majority of them are black people who refuse to stop doing that, which makes them conspire in their own death. Mm-hmm. And in mentioning that, the actor and the comedian Robin Williams died yesterday, and they said to me, listening to the news, that he was able to generate $3 billion in his acting and movie and comedian career, $3 billion. And he had won all kinds of awards. But they say he killed himself. And he was
on
a
himself,
heavy drug
on himself
user.
At that.
Now, I'm saying if we're trying to get money, and here's a man that's a billionaire and have generated it for others, what would make him be depressed? Because he had everything that we say as a people we want, a house, a car, some money in the bank, and
right.
Rich friends and wealthy friends could go anywhere in the world.
The best
it's
of anything
because
available.
Man does not live by bread alone, but by every word of truth spoken from God. And so we as Israelites, it is my desire that we become that nation that lights up or brings truth to the world. So this program of A Better World is going to talk about these issues to show how we intend to improve it in our coalitions with conscious people to show that there are things to do and things not to do, because the God we're talking about is an if and then God. If you do this, I'll do this. So first thing he says, if my people who are called by my name would humble themselves and then pray and turn away from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and heal the land and the people. So I'm saying we're putting a call out to those spiritual men and women who are listening and who you love. Will tell them there's a way that seems right, but the ways thereof bring about death. So on this program, Better World, we're going to supplement that information with better ways to do what the world is saying should be done. And I'm saying there was no way that the enemy of God's people gave him the best diet. Other than that, there wouldn't be any laws for dietary laws that the children of God got. There are some things that Leviticus pointed out early that are clean and you should eat, and some things that are unclean that you should eat. And we've gotten so far away from knowing what is scavenger food and what is healthy living. So let's start to revisiting this as we on Better World bring this information to you. Now, Brother El Ram, I'd like to go back to Sister Yaina to see if she has any callers that want any calls, or anybody in the chat room that want to raise any questions that you can answer or that I can answer. Sister Yaina.
Yes, sir. Hold on. I do have someone that pushed one. One moment. I'll get them on. Area code 240, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Sister Ayashima. Shalom, shalom.
Shalom, shalom.
I just wanted to clarify a few things about the presentation that we did yesterday. It was informative. We were not trying to do anything to bash Africa or anything about Africa, but the Ebola virus is very, very real, and it's very, very serious. And, yes, you are right when you talk about the hospital-acquired infections that people have. That's something that hospitals across this nation are working to try to prevent. This is a disease that is even more serious than that. It was never our intention to bash Africa or put Africa in a negative light. What we're trying to do is educate the people, because when you educate the people in terms of what they can do to help prevent these diseases, then we don't have to have conversations like this about the Ebola virus. We're doing the same thing in the hospitals about hospital-acquired infections. Like I said, hand washing. We're doing presentations on hand washing, not just for the staff, but also for the people who come to visit our patients. So there's a whole lot more in this. It's about education. It's not about bashing one country against another. It's about doing what we can as a people to help get rid of these diseases and to help cure some of these problems.
L. Ron, any response?
Well, the first response is that I think that when information is presented, either the information is factual or it's false. If it's factual, let's deal with it as that, okay? There's no need to be defensive. We're not attacking anybody. We're only trying to be factual and informative, okay? And that Ebola, Ebola is a very serious virus. It's a very serious ailment. But so are all these other ailments that plague people around the world, not just Ebola as it relates to Africa, because when you say Ebola, you're saying Africa, all right? So that's the only point that I'd like to clarify in terms of negative sensationalism about Africa, but this other factual information I gave, all right, we gave a practical positive responses to that, okay? Whereas Ebola is this dreaded African disease. That's the only point that I'm making in terms of how we frame things, how we approach things, which means the results that we get based on our thought and our approach are going to be different, and our feelings about Africa are certainly affected by that type of information. No need to be defensive. We're not attacking anybody.
I wasn't trying to be defensive at all. I was just trying to explain our point of view on the subject. I apologize if I came off as being defensive, but I just wanted to get our point of view across.
I understand, and I appreciate it.
And my thing with that is that there was no ambiguity, because the Yehuda Nation was given information to an audience of people who may or may not know the seriousness of Ebola, and you were informing them based on your work in medicine and based on what you know about the sanitary conditions that need to be made aware of so that people don't go to sleep on it. So we was just reinforcing, see, as a nation, which the Yehuda Nation is, and as a support part of the Yehuda Nation, and got people got to travel into Africa and into other parts of the world, they need to be aware, but they also need to know what is the agenda of the enemy to African people, so that we will know that the Coca-Cola, 12 ounces of soda pop, got 14 teaspoons of sugar in it, and it's going to erode the teeth and the stomach lining of all of the children. That's why we got diabetes coming at 15 and 16 years old, and we got heart attacks coming at 20 and 30. There's a way that they're trying to control the population, and they're doing it through diet. So we're just bringing these points, and we understand, sis, and no attack on you or the position that we take as a whole. We're just putting information out so that there's balance. That's what he was trying to say. There's no way, because I remember we were scared to death of AIDS. We didn't know if to kiss a girl anymore would be proper. We didn't know if to hold somebody's hand. And the next thing we knew, that black men were the carriers of a white homosexual disease that was first found among them. And the next thing we know, the face of AIDS turned black. Mm-hmm. So we're just trying to keep it so that our people can think and look for themselves. So thank you very much for that call.
Right.
I'd like to say something, too, as well on the subject. I think that what both sides are saying, and we say it collectively, that there's always been a target on the back of the black man, whether he's in Africa or whether he's in the United States of America, because we're the leading people of all the diseases. I mean, anytime there's something that comes that oppresses us as a nation physically, it is the black people that do that, and they automatically turn it into our behavior patterns that cause the things that happen to us to happen. But I think at the same time, you know, we know that there is a genocide set up for the African people because of the rich resources that the land has. That's the main reason why all of the propaganda has gone out, you know, and we know that they're trying to do population control on top of all of these things. You know, so the target that's on the black African is the same target that's on the black American that's here in the United States. And I think that it's very important that we make people aware, like Prince Elrond said about health issues, smoking cigarettes, you know, obesity, you know, the food market, the GMOs, all the things that we talk about all through the year to let people know this is a conspiracy to do population control, but mainly also that the black man has always been public enemy number one, and he is going to they're going to try to continue to make us be public enemy number one. So we have to understand, know what's going on, and do everything in our power to try to prevent it as much as we possibly can. With the AIDS virus, for instance, of course, AIDS is there. It's prevalent. It's real. People are contracting disease today, every day, because you know why? As much advertisements that they have out there on preventive measures, we still don't protect ourselves from the things that we need to do, because we feel like it's not going to happen to us. You know, I'm a pretty good judge of character. I can look at her or him and tell that he's all right and he don't have anything. And that's not true, because they have developed medicine now that you can live for 20 years with it. And if you really don't know, you can't tell if a person has it or not. So I think that the main thing that we're both saying is preventive measures, pay attention, listen, and take precautions, because they're out. They're out to do what they need to do to us, and that's just prevalent. It's not a conspiracy theorist. It's not people who are paranoid, but it's real. They're trying to destroy us because they know who we are.
You're absolutely right.
I agree. And in fact, I look forward to doing more educational topics with the group as a whole on things like malaria and diabetes and hypertension and childhood obesity and all those things.
And you shall, because that's part of our program. That's why we did the first three or four programs dealing with health. and we know you're working in it, and
mm-hmm.
it's going to be our health committee that you're a part of to continue to bring those things that need to be brought to the listening audience and to our people so that they can be very, very fully informed on what to do and what we as a nationalistic movement is doing about it. So I thank you so much, sis, for that response, because people might have misunderstood what Prince Elram was saying, but with the dialogue that we've had about that, I think everybody is clear.
Hallelujah. We have area code 757. That's open. 757, go ahead, you're on the air.
Kane, shalom, shalom to you all. Peace and blessings to you. This is Gavera Dina. I want to thank you for allowing me to speak. Thanks to the Most High, first and foremost. And thank you for the conversation as well. I had a question. I raised my hand to share a website if possible. But before I do that, I wanted to ask a question about Hebrew Israelites, specifically moving to Africa. And I had a website that a brother who's had a vision has moved to Ghana, particularly, and shared with me, and he's been encouraging his family, friends and family, to move there. So I'm sorry if I'm asking a question that may have been covered already. I just wanted to, again, share that website, which I will after you ask my answer the question, which is, how is it, how do you feel about moving to, let's say, Ghana or Africa versus being prepared to move to Israel, and it's Israel. Hallelujah. Okay.
I'll let you answer first, Prince, and then I'll pick it up on the second end of it.
Okay, well, my own personal experience is just as you spoke. I lived in Liberia for 12 years. Prior to living in Israel. And I lived in Ghana also. And historically, when we check historically, we find that there are people in both of those regions in particular, who have Hebrew Israelite culture in the midst of them today. That would be the Bai people in a region called Vanjima in Liberia. And, of course, we're talking about the Ashanti people and the Ga people in the country of Ghana. So it's not as if we couldn't live there, because Israelites have been there all the time. So these are wonderful places to go. There are places where you can make a very smooth transition. There are And the temperate issue would be something that you would determine, because Liberia is on the latitude of the monsoon rains, which means 66 to 70 inches of rain during rainy season. All right, whereas Ghana is more temperate, where year-round it's around the high 70s and low 80s in terms of temperature all year-round. So Ghana is a place where you can grow food all year round. It's that kind of place, all right? Whereas in Liberia, you have to deal with the monsoon rain. So those are going to be considerations in choosing, but both beautiful places, both mineral-rich places, both with Hebrew-Israelite traditions in some of the families there, and with the potential to be as much a paradise as any other place, and I found that to be the case, not only living in Liberia and Ghana, but also traveling around West Africa. There's absolutely nothing wrong with going there and settling there and then visiting Israel. No problem there, okay? And I'd like to say that in terms of going to Israel or being an Israelite and going back to Israel doesn't mean that's the only place you can go or the only place that you can be. And I encourage people to look into countries like Ghana, like Liberia, and others along the West Coast and consider them. I agree with that 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And my response also to that question is that I've been in and out of Ghana since 1973-74 and was there as a Hebrew Israelite vanguard dealing with the government. I met three presidents in Ghana. They know I'm a Hebrew Israelite. We built Hebrew Israelite projects from a factory for food to developing ecotourism on the river that brought our people into slavery to the Western world. We had a rice farm, a rice mill. We began to develop a health spa in Cape Coast, right on the ocean. As Hebrew Israelites, I also work closely with the Ghanaian people. In fact, I'm meeting with a senior Ghanaian official in the next couple of days, and I will discuss an update. I've worked very closely in West Africa with many of our people and leadership. I happen to love West Africa, and the people who wrote you love it as well, obviously, because they live there. But like any place, you got to know what it is you want from a place so that you don't go there with idealistic ideas that it's everything that you want. Because America really has spoiled us as a people because we are a supermarket people. We are a fast food people. We are a right now people because of all of the convenience that America has provided for the eye. Not that every black person in America participate in the American dream or the economy, but at least they show it to you on television and it makes you long that you can have it. All you got to do is do whatever you think you want to do to get some money to do it. That's why I was talking about Robin Williams with all the money in the world. He was depressed, American. Some say he took his own life. So we need to understand what it is we want when we go to these places so that we'll be careful. And I'm talking particularly to Israelites because our job is to go into these places and build a better environment wherever we go to take the God of Israel with us, not go there looking for it.
Hallelujah. Beautiful. Shout out to the family for sharing that. If it's okay to share the website, it's really looks beautiful. And again, you know, looks are what they are. Castle. Gate Estate, one word, Castle, GateEstate.com. You sent me a very short letter. Says to those of you who would like to relocate to the Gold Coast, Ghana, they are building subdivisions similar to those in the U.S. for affordable costs. This can be used to purchase your own home away from the U.S. or an investment to rent or use for tourism. A person can live comfortably from GH, and that's probably the, I guess, the term for the Ghanaian currency, GHC 100 per week, which is approximately 33 U.S. dollars. Gas is approximately GHC 4 per liter, which is about $1 U.S., only 0.2 gallons. And, again, this is from my brother, Sardael. I don't know if anyone recognizes that name. I know he went there, with a personal vision and has given a good report, and I'm not sure how Israel has received him, but that website, if you just take a look at it, it looks beautiful in terms of, again, from the eyes, the new subdivisions and seemingly affordable, and, you know, I just wondered if that was the right move. I mean, for me personally,
Before you go anywhere, I would recommend that you take a trip over there and see for yourself.
James, I agree.
You know, because that's the only way you're going to know. They say, look before you leap, you know.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I would recommend that you look before you leap. But both of us agree that Ghana and West Africa, and Africa in general, central, mm-hmm. west, central, east, south, north are all beautiful, but they all carry problems with them as well. Because that same malaria that we're talking about, all of those areas, you're prone to malaria because of the mosquito. And malaria is real. I've had it too. And it mm-hmm. affects you. And it affects a lot more than just a little fever. The water, you got to be careful, because all of these things are real right now. They have not evolved to the level that we are used to. But you're not in no imminent danger. But people go and get sick. That's like going to Mexico. Everybody talk about Mexico and the water. But every year we go to Mexico, or people go to Mexico. South America, the same way. So I'm just saying, all of these places wait for the sons and daughters of Yah to come and help bring the standard up to a whole nother level of consciousness and life quality. Sister Yaina, any questions before
yes,
we close out?
Yes, sir. I wanted her to give the name of the website again, because I tried to pull it up and I couldn't pull it up. Can you spell it for us so we'll know exactly what it is?
Okay, and I should have proceeded that with www.castlegateestate.com, and I will spell it. That's one word, CastleGateEstate.com. And when I clicked on it, it took me right there. So, oh boy, maybe it's... Not there anymore. Maybe the site is already down. So that's embarrassing, but I did look at it. This is what he had sent to me. I'm going to.
Yeah, I've tried it about three times, and I can't get it up. So hopefully we'll be able to pull it up and look at it at a later date and see what it is. But I think that all of it is, as you said, Prince Asiel, it's all very important that we look before we leap. You know, and that individuals that want to go and live in other countries, they are welcome to do that. There are open borders. You know, some take passports, some don't. I mean, you have the choice to do that if that's what you would like, you know, and be well when you make those choices. Be very well informed. You know, we have men on this show that have been there, done that, and, you know, it's very important that you pay attention, because I would rather take the advice from someone who has been there than someone who hasn't. So, you know, do your research and planning. If that's what you want to do, by all means do that, you know, but just make sure that you're well informed, because countries are not, like you said, we've been spoiled over here. You know, there's a whole different lifestyle in different countries, so make sure that you know that that's what you want to do. And on that note, I don't have anything else to say. I think it's been an excellent show. Very well-informed information that was necessary, and the people are definitely responding. We have quite a few people on this line that are still here, and they're interested. So, you know, we've gone up to 31,000, almost 31,500 listeners, you know, and I think that's just a blessing, because the Most High is definitely word out. So, you know, Toda to everything that you guys are doing.
Toda for you, sis, for giving us the opportunity to be a man standing next to a woman and to women of your level of consciousness and commitment. And it's our desire to bring the family back together. We don't have no issues that we are not committed to solving. Of course, we don't know everybody and everything about everybody and everything. But what we do know, we're not afraid to share it with you and tell you the good, the bad, and the ugly, so that we will be a balanced people as we go forward.
Right. All right. Well,
all right, until next week, then we'll be talking again and looking forward to bringing more information as we build a better world on our God's earth. And we encourage all of you to communicate with the Yehuda nation, better world, so that you can at least know what we as Israelites are doing around the world and in America. Until next week, peace and blessings. Shalom uvracha.
All right.
Yeah. Right. Until next week, Shalom Uvracha.